Miss Pierce, reel 10.
How long were you in Southend?
I was trying to think the other day. I don't think we were there very long. And it was about that time that we heard that we had originally been destined for Port Sudan and then to Abyssinia. But instead of that, we found ourselves on our way to Lawrence of Arabia's Daraa. And it was a very interesting journey, because when we got to a place called Baysan on the way to Daraa, we found some very wonderful Byzantine villas, or Byzantine villas, whichever you choose to call it. And they had their original mosaic floors, some of them marked out, dedicated to the four winds, and we presume different gods in the middle. They were marvellous. I've since heard that they've been very much more excavated and preserved. However, they were very interesting to us in those days.
At Sarafand, you just had men who were ill. When you got to Daraa, they were actually wounded, weren't they?
Yes, yes. But at Baysan, we put out our stretchers to sleep on, and I do just mention this, that the moonlight was so strong, we managed to write letters by moonlight. Well, then we picked our convoy up and were on our way to Daraa. And there we realized that there was a great deal of British troop movement as well as French troop movement going on, because the object was to take Lawrence of Arabia's Daraa, which was in Vichy hands. And some remarkable things happened there. The commandant, the Vichy commandant of Daraa, had ordered all wells to be blown up, and or else salt put in them in some way to render it impossible to get any water for the enemy, which was us.
And what it would do would be it would poison the water, even if you got it.
Well, blowing it up would finish it up.
And, the salt, I mean.
Salt would finish it up, you see. And there was a convent of Arab and French nuns of St. Joseph, and they ran a little school in Daraa, which was quite a small place. And the Reverend Mother, a diminutive little woman, she sat firmly on the convent well in the garden and spread her religious clothes over the well, defied the commandant to blow her up as well. She said that would be the only way that they could blow that well up, was to blow her up. So he had to retreat. And one other thing happened through the bravery of those nuns. A British officer was on a hill opposite, and if I remember rightly, he was sort of scanning Daraa through his binoculars to see what spots might need shelling, because, I mean, the enemy was in possession. And he saw this building, which stood out among the Arab buildings, and he ordered the guns to be trained onto it, and was about to give the order to fire, because he thought such a building would be some headquarters. And then rising up onto the flat roof were some little Arab nuns, and absolutely touching faith in the British. They told us afterwards, they said, we knew the British wouldn't hurt us. So they showed themselves on the roof, and he caught them in his binoculars in time, and he ordered ceasefire. And
why did they think that? Was that because of Lawrence?
I don't know, but they had touching faith in us, because they had been rather badly treated by the Vichy. It was the bravery of these little nuns of Daraa that saved one well, which was pure water, and saved a main building, which we were able to use for our patients. And we then put up our tents in the desert nearby, very well spaced out. But I remember rightly, one tent was over a cesspool. And I got bitten by a virulent, nasty, filthy mosquito, which led to a septic leg later. And then we got very busy. We were being machine gunned most of the time by the Vichy. And at about that time, I think, when we got there, we had as prisoner the commandant of Daraa. He was wounded. And I think it was about 7 or 8 others. And the Free French were very touching about this because they were their fellow countrymen. And they were quite sure that they would be friendly with them, you know, that they could win them over. But Frenchman against Frenchman was a terrible thing, and it was a thing that I think nobody had dreamt would be so serious. They would not be friendly with the Free French. And one of the nurses came to Mrs. Spears, I remember. I think it was Evelyn Fulroth. And she said that the commandant was stirring up trouble in the ward. We'd taken part of the convent and turned it into a ward. And the 7 others wouldn't cooperate either, which was quite a shock to the Free French, because they said that never in the whole of this war would they befriend the Free French. They would only kill. And this was Frenchman against Frenchman, which gave one an insight as to what to expect, because nobody had expected such a thing. And we did all we could to be nice and pleasant to them, and the Free French did so too, to try and win over these colonials to join the Free French, but it was absolutely hopeless. And we turned, the convent had some outhouses, and we turned them into the operating theatre, because we had, I think I told you, wonderful equipment, and we had everything that we needed to set up theatre anywhere, and sterilising room.
Yes, but what about a source of supplies?
We arrived with a tremendous amount of material, and we had made previous arrangements from England that the source of supplies would come up. Now, I am not sure, because I was just one of the sisters there, but I think they came up via base hospitals. But they were our own equipment, nothing from the army. Some things were bought from the army. But everything was privately bought and paid for. Nothing was issued by the army to us. The Free French had money from the British, and we got equipment through them as well. But I believe that it was very businesslike, and from America, Mrs. Spears got most of her supplies originally. They came, we presume, regularly through the ports up to us. I really don't think that any of us who were actually doing the work stopped to wonder where it was all coming from.
Was there always an adequate supply?
At that time, yes, there was. And we had a tremendous amount of wounded, which, of a necessity, the wounded were brought in at night for safety's sake. And consequently, Colonel Fruchot and Nancy Wright, our theatre sister and our French surgeon, operated all night. And I don't know how it was, but I was on night duty again. And we used to spend our time sorting out the stretcher cases, those that we thought, we only had hurricane lamps, don't forget, and those that we thought could be operated on then and whose lives might be saved. But whilst this was being done, some, I'm afraid, did die. That had we had more people to help us might have been saved. But it was the only way we could do it was to pick out those that were more likely to be saved, to be dealt with first. And I'd like to point out, because in this day and age it's not quite understood, I suppose, that among the British, in fact, we were told later that as well as all the work for the Free French, our little band had through our hands a third of the British wounded on that sector. And this
how far did they have to come to you?
Well, I think they came via Palestine, where they actually came from. I'm afraid they were fighting all around. But they came via Palestine originally, as we did.
And by what means did they come?
Well, they had all their army trucks and jeeps and whatever other equipment they had, and tanks and things, we presume. But they weren't yet in Deraa, the British. This was on the outskirts of Deraa. We were the only ones with the Free French in Deraa itself. This is what I would like to point out, is that British officers who came from families that had nannies, in those days, they were with the nannies far more than they were with their mothers. And as they were dying, they would call out for nanny, not mother. It was always nanny. Nanny, don't leave me. They were so young. And we held their hands and let them think that we were the nanny. And I can remember one young man, one young officer, holding my hand and saying, murmuring as he was dying, "Nanny, don't leave me." But it was never their mothers they called out for, because they only had about an hour with their mothers a day. Any time, I mean, weekends or any time, you know, they just were brought up by the nanny. And the nanny was the one they clung to. Well, at that time, they started machine gunning us very badly. And we used to run across the desert. It was extraordinary when I look back on it, and I can actually see the bullets spattering in the sand, and it had no effect on us. The one thing was that we must join those that were on duty to go and look after the patients. And we ran through the desert. Looking back on it, we were foolhardy. So we just didn't sink in that this spattering in the sand all around us was literally bullets. But none of them touched us. Some of our American orderlies, who were film stars and people like that, dived under trucks. And I don't think I ought to be rude whilst there's a tape recording, in case someone gets hold of it. But their sit-upons used to stick out the back. We used to wonder whether they were going to be used as pincushions. However, they weren't hurt. Nobody was hurt. And at that time, the flies were absolutely frightful. And by that time, I'd left the cesspit tent, and I had a tent on my own because I was on night duty, but constantly broken with machine guns and flies. Well, I have seen flies in Egypt since, but I have never seen flies as we had them then, and they bothered me so much that I made them a present of my tent, and I went to see the Reverend Mother, and she let me put a mattress on one of the school tables in the convent, so I didn't have machine gun bullets all round me. And I didn't have flies and virulent mosquitoes, so I did manage to get a little bit of sleep. And we used to spend, as I said, our nights sorting out the wounded. Then we had a message from the base, British military base hospital at Nazareth. And they asked us who we were who sent the wounded down from the front in such perfect condition. Now, Colonel Fruchot, our French surgeon who'd escaped from France with us, had developed this method during the Spanish Civil War, which was heard of in those days, whereby he turned each bad wound into a major operation, so that it was all clean, you see. It was aseptic, as it was, you know. He'd done a proper operation and removed all the infected tissue, and then packed it with septoplex and put them in plaster. And we had, for those days, very modern type of stretchers with our equipment, which the British Army didn't have. And they were sort of strapped into these things and sent back down to base. And Nazareth sent back a message, you see, wondering who we were, because they didn't have to touch these wounded for 3 months, at least, because they were so in such perfect condition. And that it was then that we heard that we had a third of the wounded, British wounded, through our hands. Well,
can you remember anything else of the techniques that you used there that might be different from what was being used here, perhaps?
Well, of course, we had no such thing as penicillin, the antibiotics that are used nowadays, so that this was the main method, and septoplex was the main thing that we used, as we'd used in France.
Is that a disinfectant?
Yes, it was. It was a powder that was packed into the wounds, which was very, very effective, and kept the wounds clean. But of course we hadn't yet got to the bad wounds that we were to meet later on.
What sort of wounds were you dealing with?
Oh, we were dealing with amputations and, facial wounds, body wounds, multiple wounds of all kinds, very severe, very nasty, and, as I say, many amputations, and otherwise major operations onto the wounds of any part of the body, and many fatalities, of course. Very, very many did.
What happened to them?
Well,
was there a cemetery there?
We presume that they made a cemetery. Well, there must have been a cemetery there, because there were people living there. I'm afraid I don't know about that. All I know is about the nursing of the living, and when there were the dead, they were removed by orderlies, French or English. And I really can't tell you what happened to them. I do remember that in France, the first of the ones that died, we started a potato field and made it into a cemetery, started burying them there. But I should imagine that there were cemeteries. Would be attached to the churches and the missions, and were probably taken back into Palestine. I should imagine that the British were taken back into Palestine. I really, really don't know about that side of it, because I was there to keep people alive, and I'm afraid that, you know, that side of it, we were far too busy to start with, to stop and think of what was happening beyond what we were doing. Because those nights were very, very hectic. Well, then they blew up the railway, and that was the time that we realised. And the British were back, were into Deraa by then. There was fighting between the British and the Free French against the Vichy, and we realised then that it was about time that we moved on to Damascus. So we packed up all our equipment, and our wounded were sent back to base, to Nazareth, as they were every morning. They were collected every morning at sunrise by ambulances and taken back to base hospitals, because we couldn't keep any wounded up there. And we moved on to Damascus, and I do remember thinking at the time of St. Paul, and how he'd gone on that very same road that we had taken, and struck with blindness, as you know, and that when he eventually saw Damascus, he must have seen it much as we saw it, because in St. Paul's day, Damascus was already very old. So I believe there are many changes now, but when we saw it, we must have seen it much as he did when he got his sight, and before he lost his sight. And I took a photo of the old wall, the part where they, a tower with a window in it, which was said to be the one from which St. Paul was lowered. You know, it comes into the New Testament. And it was all very interesting and very inspiring. And we took over a Salesian convent, which was very well, missionary convent, which was very well built. It had two buildings. One was a school, and one was a very, very well equipped, a very well built hospital. And joined by a corridor from each of the buildings onto a central church or chapel. And the Free French turfed them all out of the hospital, and their pupils and the nuns and the nursing nuns all had to live in the school building. And we had to take over the hospital for the wounded, which was soon very full. And there were some beautiful airy wards and some single wards, and one very large room, which I've often wondered what it was for. It was a very large empty room paved with marble. We put our sleeping bags down on there and made it our nurse's sort of habitat. And at about that time, my septic bite, I believe, got worse, and I was told to be confined to bed, which was my sleeping bag. But however, I was entertained by various officers and Evelyn Fulroth, and I'm afraid I didn't stay lying down for very long, because we had such a lot of wounded that I just had to get on with the job. And about that time, Madame Catrou, now General Catrou, was the commander of the sector, the officer in charge of the Vichy sector. He came over from the colonials under General de Gaulle. And Madame Catrou, his wife, came to us in great agitation one day and said that in another hospital in Damascus, she had found some Free French, completely neglected, in the most dreadful condition. Though she had sent pillows and bedding and sheets and dressings, so you see, the Free French did have their own supplies of dressings, obviously, and she had collected them through her ladies that helped her, the colonial ladies. And she'd sent all that for use for the Free French in this hospital, which incidentally was run by French nuns. And she went to visit and found that all the equipment had been used for the Vichy, and the Free French were lying on bare mattresses and pillows, if they were lucky, in a most putrid state, some of them crying out for water, but just neglected. So Colonel Fruchot took some nurses and went with Mrs. Spears to see what was what. And it was absolutely horrifying. And to me, as a Catholic, it was doubly horrifying that this should be in a convent. There should have been this difference made between their own countrymen, just because some were Vichy colonials and some were Free French. But the difference was made, and they were in a pitiable state, in a dreadful state. So Mrs. Spears said she'd send the ambulances immediately round, our own ambulances, to fetch them. And they were brought back to our little Italian hospital, which was spotless. And some of them, I'm afraid, did die, but Colonel Fruchot operated on as many as he could and did his usual operations, leaving some of the plasters open above some wounds which were so bad that they were full of maggots. And I remember I sterilized a spoon and used it to, this may revolt you, but it's one of those things, to spoon out the maggots and the pus. Was to that degree. But they were the saving of the wounds, because the maggots were eating the putrefaction. So in a way they were doing good. But that was the state that these patients were in, And somewhere I've got a snapshot of three we call the Three Musketeers. They'd all got their arms in plaster and at an angle, and their chests bandaged where they'd been operated. And they, when they were first put into our beds, we had, I think I told you originally, rather been laughed at the bedding equipment that we had taken out for frontline surgical nursing. Lanier cell, pale blue Lanier cell blankets and sheets and pillowcases, you know, it just hadn't been heard of before. But when we put these men into these beds, their wonderment was absolutely unbelievable. They just couldn't get over it after lying on those putrid mattresses for so long. They were suddenly put into beautiful beds with pale blue Lanier cell blankets and looked after and kept clean. You know, their wounds seen to, and as much to drink as they wanted, and food.
I'm surprised they were willing to give these men up to you. Wouldn't they have regarded them as prisoners?
Well, they couldn't, you see. By then, we were in charge. By we, I mean the British and the Free French were in charge, and the Vichy colonials were enemies. And I can go back to when we went to fetch them, because I've never before or since been so rude to a Reverend Mother as I was on that particular day. And I do remember very clearly asking her why this had happened, why this segregation. And she said, well, we had to obey orders. And I lost my temper. And as you know, I speak French. And in French, I said to her, but you're brides of Christ, and you make your vows to Christ. You don't make your vows to the Vichy. And surely you should be Christ-like, and that any wounded, just as with us when we had the German wounded in France, they were wounded and we treated them. To us, they were all wounded. And surely you should be more Christ-like and have seen them all as wounded. Didn't matter whether they were Vichy or Free French. And I'm afraid I let rip at her. I couldn't help it. It was just such a terrible shock to me that she should say we had orders. But, I mean, she had nothing to, she shouldn't have obeyed those orders. They were nothing to do with her, surely. Anyway, we saved as many as we could of them. And
you had an unpleasant accident in that hospital, I think.
Oh, yes. We always had the men and officers searched on admission downstairs because they carried firearms, and we wouldn't have any firearms upstairs on the wards, of course. And on this particular occasion, a French captain arrived, and he had his little knapsack thing with him. And I went to see that he was settled in with a captain that we'd had for some time who had been operated on and was doing very nicely. He was going to recover. And it was a two-bedded ward. And I remember pushing the knapsack under the bed with my foot. And I looked back on it. I did it at great risk, for I'd hardly got down to the ward where we had some very severely wounded men, and we were very busy looking after them, when I heard a pistol shot. And I ran back up the corridor and to the two-bedded room, and the new officer that had just arrived was sitting up in bed looking all right. But unfortunately, our captain, who was on the mend, was very white. He'd been shot in the stomach. It seemed that in this knapsack, this wretched man had a pistol. Not only had he got the pistol, but it was cocked at the ready and popped into his knapsack. Utter carelessness. And how they passed it downstairs, we don't know. The search wasn't done properly. It ricocheted on the wall and went through the stomach of our recovering captain.
So nobody had even touched it then?
No. Oh, I had touched it with my foot. And he'd carried it upstairs. He had picked it up, apparently, to get something out, and dropped it on the floor. And as he dropped it on the floor, so the pistol went off. And Colonel Frouchot took the cap